This is the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. As we always do, we are producing two podcasts this week. We're going to be talking in detail on both podcasts with our special guest expert, Mr. Todd Knoop. We'll be talking about what's going on with China's economy as well as other economies around the world, and we'll talk about what that might mean for you and your money. Also on today's podcast, as well as the next podcast this week, I'll be talking about the manage risk strategy. It's a strategy that we'll talk about at a very high level. A hypothetical example is what we'll be using to explain the strategy on the next couple podcasts. If you'd like more information about the strategy in detail, we do offer it in our Investors Discovery Kit. You can get a copy of that at no charge by simply visiting investingapproach.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest here on Everything Financial Radio, Professor Todd A. Knoop, who is the David Joyce Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College. Todd is the author of multiple articles as well as books. His most recent book, Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust, is right up the alley of many of our listeners. We're excited to have him on the program. And Todd, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Todd, let's start with just the premise of your book, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. I should say the subtitle of your book. Understanding recessions and depressions in these cycles would certainly be something that would be very handy for many of our listeners. Is it possible to understand and predict these cycles?
Prediction, probably not. You know, it's been said that an economist is somebody who can tell you why something happened after it happened. And I think that's basically true about business cycles, is that business cycles remain very, very difficult to predict. And I think part of the reason that that is that business cycles are not the same. And in fact, really this terminology of using a business cycle is really a misnomer, because a business cycle kind of indicates that it's something regular and predictable. And in fact, business cycles are somewhat irregular. They're very unpredictable. I think they're caused by many different sorts of phenomena. I think that a lot of people, both on the left and the right of the political spectrum, have interesting things to say, and actually quite appropriate things to say about business cycles. And so it's not, you know, it's an issue that doesn't boil down to a simple yes, no, black, white, this always is responsible for this kind of scenario. It's actually very complex. There's a lot of nuance. And so that's, of course, one of the reasons why I'm interested in it, is because it seems like there's always more to learn and more to understand.
So, Todd, give me your perspective on an opinion on cycles, economic cycles. Do you believe that economic cycles repeat themselves?
Well, they do. They do. But as I said, you know, they don't repeat themselves in predictable ways. You know, it's been said, you might have heard this quote before, but that the most expensive words in finance is that this time it's different, right? And that's one of the things we see about business cycles, is that particularly as it pertains to these asset bubbles, usually when the bubble is building, there's people out there saying, no, this time it's different. History doesn't repeat itself. And then we step back a few years later, and in fact, we see that history does repeat itself, maybe not in quite the same ways, right? There might be subtle differences, but in practice, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of repetition through history. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, one thing that we can be certain of is that there will be another business cycle. There will be another financial crisis. It's just a question of when and where.
Yeah, when you were speaking, Todd, I was reminded of the book written by Reinhardt and Roghoff, and the title was This Time is Different. So certainly that's been an oft-repeated phrase. Let me ask you this. Given the current economic conditions, we had an asset bubble in real estate that built and burst. Are you seeing that there are asset bubbles that exist now based upon your research?
Well, I don't particularly see an asset bubble in any U.S. asset markets at this point, but I think there's also there's a lot to be worried about in foreign markets. You know, particularly one of the things that economists are very worried about is what's happening in China. While there's some evidence that the real estate bubble in China has been deflating a little bit, you know, real estate prices and other asset prices in China are extremely high. And, you know, another thing that's going on in China is that there's a lot of debt in China. We think about China as lending us money, but if you look at the details, you know, there's a lot of debt, personal debt, local government debt in China. And so that's a threat to the U.S. economy to the extent that, you know, the Chinese and U.S. economies are inexorably linked. A financial crisis in China would have big impacts on what would happen here in the U.S. And so while I'm not predicting anything, you know, here in the next 3 months or 6 months, I think it's something that investors and all Americans should keep an eye on, is that we just can't ignore what's going on in places like China.
You know, let's talk about China, Todd. It's interesting you brought that up. And if you're just joining us, we are chatting with Todd Knoop, who is author of the book Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. I'd encourage you to check it out. I'm sure it's available on Amazon. Todd, talk about what's going on in China, because as you said, a lot of people think China is the largest creditor nation on earth, which is true. But when you look at personal debt and local government debt is quite high. And are we seeing China's real estate market now starting to implode, similar to what we saw in the United States not that long ago?
Possibly. I mean, one of the things that's been happening in China is that the government and the Central Bank of China have been trying to gradually let some of the air out of the bubble, right? So they've been tightening up lending standards. They've been gradually raising interest rates to try to reduce the provision of credit. But, you know, what's going on in China, it's a very complex system, because basically the formal banking system is all orientated toward giving finance to these big state-owned corporations where very little of actual economic growth in China is occurring. Most private companies get their lending from informal markets, right? From people that they know, from, you know, these kind of backyard markets where, you know, people know somebody who knows somebody who's willing to become an investor. And that's all fine and good, but the problem is that we don't really know what's going on in those markets, right? It's very difficult to figure out exactly what kind of risk that people are exposed to. We don't even know what kind of risk the big banks in China are exposed to, because while they might lend to these state-owned enterprises, the state-owned enterprises oftentimes turn around and lend it to private individuals. So it's an incredibly convoluted system that, quite honestly, I don't think anybody really has a great grasp for, including the Chinese government. And so while, as I said, they're trying to, you know, gradually let a little bit of the air out of the bubble, you know, there's always a question about whether they're going to be able to do that appropriately, and whether there's some shock out there that would really expose the system for the somewhat convoluted mess that it is.
So, Todd, we've got about a little over a minute left. Assuming that China's economy has the proverbial hard landing, how will U.S. investors be affected?
Well, you know, U.S. investors would probably be impacted in many more ways than they could possibly imagine, or even I could possibly imagine, in the sense that, you know, obviously there's a demand for U.S. goods in China. You know, so we think about the traditional import and export channels, but then there's all sorts of other ways that the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy are linked. You know, one of the big ways is that, of course, the Chinese government buys U.S. bonds. Right? And so if the demand for those bonds dry up, that could lead to higher interest rates in the U.S. There's also all sorts of financial linkages in that U.S. banks and many U.S. citizens through their 401k accounts are invested in China, and so either directly or indirectly through international corporations. And so if the Chinese economy begins to slump, that's going to affect returns on all these international corporations. And so, you know, it's, you know, not to cop out on your question, but it's really there's such a complex web of linkages between the U.S. and China that, you know, it's very difficult to predict what will happen, other than the fact that, yes, certainly U.S. investors are going to be impacted quite significantly if there is a bust in China.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Professor Todd Knoop, who is the David Joyce Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College. His book is Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. Glad you decided to tune in today. You know, in this particular segment, I want to talk today about some alternate strategies that you might consider for your nest egg, given that we believe we're in an economic winter season. Now, a lot of financial professionals out there use what I like to call the one bucket approach to managing a nest egg. Well, what is the one bucket approach? Well, the one bucket approach typically has all your assets in stocks and bonds, or stock mutual funds and bond mutual funds. And the old rule of thumb used by a lot of financial professionals is that the older you are, the more money you should have in bonds. And certainly that can be a strategy that can work well in many circumstances, but it's our belief that moving ahead, that one bucket approach might not work very well. Why? Well, if interest rates today are at low levels, which I believe we can all agree that interest rates are at low levels, the next logical move in interest rates will be for interest rates to move higher. When that happens, what will happen to the value of a bond fund? Well, bond funds and interest rates move inversely or in opposite directions. So if a bond fund were to decline in value, it would mean that interest rates were going up, or in a cause and effect type relationship, as interest rates go up, bond funds decline. As far as stocks, it's our view that the stock market at this point is likely ready for a correction. Now, it may not be this month or even this year, but when you take a look at a number of technical and fundamental indicators, this market is likely overvalued again, in our opinion. You'll certainly find folks that will disagree with that. So in this segment, I want to talk about how do you potentially take some of this downside risk and attempt to control it to a little greater extent. And the example that I always like to use is, if you like to go to the casino, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, but if you do go to the casino, my guess is you decide in advance how much money you're willing to lose. You only put $50 in your wallet, and when that money's gone, you quit gambling. You don't put all your capital at risk. You don't have all your capital or all your assets in play, and yet a lot of folks who use the one bucket approach to managing their nest egg have all their assets in play. They have theoretically all their assets at risk. So I want to give you a strategy that you might consider. And let me say before I start that this strategy is not going to work for everybody. It may not be right for you. And I'm going to talk purely about this strategy in a hypothetical sense. Now, the strategy I want to talk about is something called the manage risk strategy. And the objective of the manage risk strategy are to protect assets and achieve a 0 to maybe 20% growth rate each year. We don't want to lose money. Now, let me say that there's no guarantee that this objective will be achieved, but if you could get a 0 to 20% return every year, and possibly take the risk of losing money off the table, is that something that might make sense? Well, let me explain this managed risk strategy to you again hypothetically, and I'll give you a hypothetical example. Let's take the example of Jack. Jack has $65,000 invested in an index fund, and we'll just call this hypothetical fund XYZ Fund. Now, an index fund, for those of you that are not aware, or maybe aren't familiar with that term, is typically an unmanaged fund based on a market index. So the index fund will typically attempt to get about the same return as a market index by buying all the stocks in a particular index. Well, Jack, in this example, again, has $65,000 invested in an index fund, and we'll call this index fund, as we said, XYZ Fund. And Jack has 500 shares of XYZ Fund, and the share price is $130. So take 500 shares times $130, and that's Jack's $65,000 balance. Now, if the related market index were to decline by 50% while Jack owns this index fund, Jack would likely find that his investment would decline by about 50%. On the other hand, if the related index were to appreciate by 50%, Jack's probably going to be a happy guy. Jack's going to find that his investment would also appreciate by about 50%. When Jack has some of his assets invested in an index fund, theoretically speaking, 100% of his assets are at risk. Now, indexes typically don't decline 100%, but he's got 100% of his capital in play. Now, as we have discussed, it's our opinion that in an economic winter environment, this could be risky. Now, rather than have 100% of his capital in play, an XYZ fund, what if Jack decides to take his $65,000 and go out and purchase individual corporate bonds? Now, we don't want Jack to buy bond funds because, as I talked about at the onset of this segment, if interest rates go up or rise, bond funds will go down or decline. So the corporate bonds that Jack buys are individual bonds. He buys them on the secondary market, and he ladders the maturity date. And now when I say Jack is going to ladder the maturity date, he's going to have some coming due in maybe 2 years, some coming due in 3 years, some coming due in 4 years. When CDs were more popular because they had better yields than they have today, a lot of folks would ladder maturities on CDs. So we're going to do the same thing here with bonds, and there's going to be some criteria that we're going to use to select our bonds. So don't go right out and try to implement this strategy because you heard it on the radio program today. There are a lot of moving parts, and there's some due diligence that you need to do to make this work. However, it's important to understand that there may be strategies out there other than the one bucket approach that you can use to manage your assets that might allow you to get a 0 to 20% return every year and take the downside potentially out of play. Well, Jack decides which bonds he'll buy, and he diversifies his holdings, and he buys no more than 5 bonds in any one company. Now, bonds are typically denominated in increments of $1,000. So Jack goes out and buys bonds issued by 12 different companies. That theoretically further reduces his risk because Jack has diversified. Now, in this hypothetical example, let's assume that Jack realizes an average yield to maturity on his bond portfolio of 4%. That means that Jack will earn interest of about $2,600 annually on his portfolio of $65,000. Now, it's important to also understand that the value of these bonds can fluctuate between the time Jack buys them and maturity, but provided that company is in business at maturity and is capable of paying off the bond, paying off the loan essentially that you've made to the company, Jack knows what his return will be exactly from the time he buys it until the maturity date. So it's important that Jack is able to hold these bonds to maturity. Well, Jack likes the safety of his portfolio because now if the stock market crashes or corrects, Jack's not going to participate. However, Jack would like to have the opportunity to get returns that are greater than the 4% interest that he's earning on his bond portfolio. That's all the time I have to talk about the managed risk strategy on this podcast. However, I will be continuing the discussion on the managed risk strategy on this week's second podcast. You want to be sure to tune in and listen to that. Also, on the second podcast this week, I'll be continuing my conversation with Mr. Todd Noop, and we'll hear what he has to say about asset bubbles that may exist in today's economy. If you'd like to get more information about the managed risk strategy, I would invite you to visit the website investingapproach.com. You can request a free investor's discovery kit at that website. The investor's discovery kit contains a copy of my book, New Retirement Rules, and in the book I talk in detail about using the managed risk strategy. That's all for this first podcast of the week. Listen in again in just a couple days. Bye.